Well, good morning. If you're wondering, if you weren't here last week, our notes are in fact a blank piece of paper, and you're going to get to color and draw here today and enjoy that along the way. This is just a brief kind of two-part little mini-series. We're talking about the metaphysical dream. Metaphysical dream. I'm borrowing that term from a man named Richard Weaver. He was a philosopher. He died in, I think, the 1960s. That's another way of talking about a worldview, the way in which we imagine the world as it is. And we're going to see today that all people do that. The reason we're talking about that is just to kind of give us a sense of what has changed in our culture and how people in societies like Western American society, Europe also, has changed. How have they changed fundamentally in the way that they view the world and reality? That's what we're looking at. Now, last week, we noted that we live in an era that is defined by expressive individualism. Expressive individualism, and I'm just going to do a little review here, and then we're going to press forward a little further. That phrase was invented by the American scholar Robert Bella. He defined it this way: expressive individualism holds that each person has a unique core of feeling and intuition that should unfold or be expressed if individuality is to be realized. We noted that that's something fundamentally new in the way that human beings have existed. Also, we highlighted the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor. He speaks of the culture of authenticity, and he says each one of us has his or her own way of realizing our humanity, and that it's important to find and live out one's own way of humanity, that is, as against surrendering to conformity with a model imposed on us from the outside by society or the previous generation or by religious or political authority. And I think that these two guys are onto something, that is the predominant way in which most people exist in our society today. And we were asking, how did we get there a little bit? How did we get there? We started with a little bit of philosophy, and we noted two problems that people have wrestled with for thousands of years. The first problem is that everyone recognizes that we have massive amounts of information that floods our minds, that we know exists but don't actually register in our mind. Remember, if you're here with us last week, we did that exercise where you had 2 minutes to write down everything that existed in this room. And we recognized that you could not possibly do that in 2 minutes. Even if we collected all the answers in this room, we would not have all the things that exist in this room in 2 minutes. In fact, it would take us hours to try to register. And of course, then you're asking, how far do we go? Do we get down to the subatomic particle, atomic particles? You know, all of these things exist in this room to describe them. And so we have all of this information that is flooding at us constantly. And so we recognize, and humans have recognized this, this isn't a Christian thing, humans have recognized this for a long, long time. There's a distinction between our sensation, what we sense, and our perception, what we perceive. And human beings have wrestled with that problem for a long time. We only perceive certain things out of the world that we exist. A second problem is that we have our minds, and we have the world which is full of events and objects. How does our mind relate to the world? Okay? So we think about things up here, and we see things, we taste things, we touch things, and so on, with all of our senses out there. How do those things relate to what goes on up here? Can we know with our minds what is actually real in the world? And human beings have wrestled with these issues for a long time. And we noted that three dominant views of the world and how we should view the world have emerged over time. Last week, we looked at one of those views with pre-modern man. Pre-modern man. I'm doing this fairly quickly so we get to our material for today. I remember that as we talked about pre-modern man, that we begin with the individual. And for the individual, as he looks at the world, he has his thoughts. He has his thoughts. But the world has, first of all, an order to it. We noted that. The world is ordered for pre-modern man. And by pre-modern, just a reminder, we're talking about roughly mid-1600s in that range. There are shifts that are happening already in the 1600s, but roughly in that range. The height of modernity starts to explode during the Enlightenment of the 1700s. But pre-modern man, the world is ordered. Also for pre-modern man, the world is transcendent. The world is transcendent. That is to say that there is a transcendent reality that exists, God or the gods. And pre-modern man said that what we see in the world is not only transcendent, but it's also moral. It's moral. And that morality cuts across and even lines in it. Now, pre-modern man, we noted this last week, believed that what existed in the mind of God, in the person of God, actually also existed here. That what we have up here, or I should say it this way, what we have here is a copy of the way in which God has ordered the world. God has ordered the world a certain way, certain ways, we could even say. And it's ordered, it's transcendent, it's moral. We noted that for pre-modern man, he begins with revelation. Revelation must come from God to human beings in order for us to actually understand fully the way the world works. Pre-modern man believed in truth with a lowercase t. They would say true propositions correspond to the way in which reality in the immanent world actually exists. And we also noted that there is truth with a capital T. There is the truth, the whole ordered system, which aligns itself with the way in which God has ordered it. Human beings first took their revelation from God. Oh, I should note that we talked about this view as philosophical realism. Human beings and pre-modern man first looked to God for revelation, and then they believed that from God they could make a correct mental image of the world fully. Not just the stuff of the world, but the moral order of the world. This is pre-modern mankind. And so we noted, as we thought about this, that this person believed that really the truth, the ultimate truth, was up here, up there. We look there for the truth. We don't look out into the world to find ultimate truth. We look here. And then we can understand the way the world actually exists. We also compared this, and I'm borrowing this from Kevin Bowder, and he uses his illustration, that pre-modern man is kind of like somebody that exists in a city, lots of streets, maybe got rivers running through it, so you got angled streets, and you know it's not just in a perfect grid. And imagine that you're in the city, and you're in some sort of big storm. I mean, we just had one of these huge like gully washers on Thursday night, right? You know, if you ever been in a city when it is just absolutely downpouring rain, and it's really hard to figure out where you're going, especially if you don't live there, you don't know where you're going. Pre-modern man said that God or the gods have given us a map to understand the world, a map to understand the city. We might say we've got a GPS sitting there telling us exactly where we are and where we need to go. This was the view of pre-modern man, also known as philosophical realism. All right, so that's what we talked about last week. Let's get to some new material this week. Y'all remember in this? Remember the stuff that we covered? Okay. Now, something shifts in the world, and that brings us to modern man. Modern man. The modern, or modernity is another word you'll hear talk about this, begins to develop primarily in the 17th century and into the 18th centuries. However, the seeds were actually sown for modernity, as we know it philosophically, earlier in the 14th century. And they start with a man named William of Ockham. William of Ockham. Ockham is a place in England. All right. William of Ockham was an English Franciscan friar. He was a philosopher and Catholic theologian. All right. So he was a believer in God. He's most famous for what's known in logic as Occam's Razor. Anybody heard of Occam's Razor before? What do we got? Tell me what Occam's Razor says. Somebody shout it out. I remember the term, but now I don't remember what it actually means, all right? What do we got?
Simplest math is probably the right one.
There we go. That's a really good way of describing it. The simplest solution, the simplest path is probably the right one. So if you've got a problem and you have four different ways of solving it that all seem like they could be good solutions, more than likely the simplest solution or the solution with the smallest set of ways to get to your solution is probably the right one. Okay? So that's Occam's Razor. Okay, so he developed that theory. He was a brilliant man. Also, we should note we're talking the 14th century here. So when you say Roman Catholic, that's pre-Reformation. You know, it's hard to know what he believed actually about the gospel fully, and during this time period. But he's also, more importantly for our discussion here, he's the pioneer of a movement called nominalism. And I told you last week, I only had a couple of phrases last week, like expressive individualism, that'll be difficult. This is one of the few phrases here this week that I think will be difficult. It's not actually that difficult. Nominalism, just it's a big word, nominalism. Nominalism denies that universals, such as universal metaphysical ideas, have any significance. Universals have no significance. And what it does is it says that the reality that we perceive by the intellect, by our minds, that reality which is perceived by the intellect, that is what is real. It's only perceived by the senses. Okay, so reality is primarily explained, understood by the senses. See here if I could do this. If I go back a few slides to show the difference. No, it's going to make me do all of this. Sorry. Shouldn't have done that. Because now it's going to want me to do these one by one by one by one by one by one. So we get to where we need to be. And hopefully I don't go too far. Tap the screen too many times. This took me a long time to make all this build order, by the way. What nominalism says is that what is really real is seen only in what our mind perceives by our senses in the world. That's where reality is. We can't actually perceive things like moral realities in the world. We can't do that. Those would be universals. So a universal idea of something like courage. If you were to try to define for me what is courage, you might be able to give me examples of a point in the world of, oh, here is a courageous act. But nominalists would say, can you actually define courage? Try it, by the way. Can you give me a definition of courage that actually encompasses all acts of courage in the world? Can we?
The red badge of courage.
Okay, but that is something that is imaginative, but it doesn't actually define every single act of courage. So nominalists said, hey, we got the world, and it's full of events and objects. There is such a thing as courage, but we can't actually define it fully. It doesn't exist as a universal, and even if it did, how would we know it?
We see the blood.
That's an example, a specific one, but it is not a universal. Okay, I don't believe in nominalism, but that's what they're going to say. Okay, all right. So William of Ockham, he pioneers this movement. The old view said that there was a real, transcendent, and objective truth that had objective values that really do exist outside of what a person senses, and that God has revealed those things to us, or the gods have revealed it to us. Ockham says, well, it's probably true that they exist, but we can't actually know it. Okay? Not in, because what's really real is what we perceive through our senses. Now, don't immediately think about God here. Ockham fully believed that there was a God. What he said was that there were no metaphysical universal values that exist. So things like courage, valor, freedom, compassion, those are not things. And over time, the nominalists, after Ockham lived, right? Over time, the nominalists, they began to say that those things like courage, valor, freedom, compassion, that those things were creation of our minds. Pre-modern man said courage is a very real thing that even if we can't perceive it, it does in fact exist. Modern man says, maybe, but I can't perceive it. I can't sense it. I can't see it, touch it, taste it, smell it, hear it. Therefore, I don't know if it really exists. Courage is merely a product of our minds. So let's think about here, you know, if you want to draw along with me on this, you're welcome to. Here's some differences between modern man and pre-modern man. Start with man, and he's got thoughts. He's got an intellect. He's got a mind. Now for modern man, he starts out by believing that there is an ordered world. There's order to the world. William of Ockham and the nominalists, they believed that there was an ordered world. The modern man even believed that the world was moral. All right? And that world was ordered, it was moral. So that's fine, they believe that. You go in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, they all believe this. Ockham believed in the transcendent. He believed that only faith could get us to God. But his break between the universals of God and the immanent world was profound. And over time, people first began to look at immanent reality first. And they would use their reason, their intellect, to understand this reality first and foremost. And that was lifted up what was in the world over revelation. Now, they would have said there is a transcendent order, that it does exist, but that the connection between this and that is not knowable because you can't see it, touch it, taste it, smell it, hear it. You can't perceive it. Are you tracking with this so far? All right. Okay. This is modern man. The problem is that if all you do is start staring at the world, and in fact what they began to do is they began to think that, yes, there may have been, it may be a transcendent, but what you need to do is reason from what we can experience with our senses to God. The problem is over time, you actually lose the transcendent. And that's the story of the 17, 18, and 1900s in Western civilization. Just over time, God gets pushed further and further and further out from existence. So by the time you get to the late 1800s, the German theologians and spilling over into America and the rest of Europe, I mean, they're saying that basically, in essence, there are no universals. The only thing that we can do is to reason back to God for what he's actually like. All right. So this was sown in the 1300s, and it took a long time in society to bloom. Whether or not there is a God is not very important. All right. So we start with looking at the world first, and then we go back to God. By the time you get to the 18th and the 19th century, huge philosophical changes are taking place in the world. Once you start to deny a connection between the transcendent mind of God and its connection to immanent reality, things begin to fall apart. Anybody heard of the term deism before? All right, the deists were perfectly good examples of modern man. Benjamin Franklin was a deist. Okay, that's probably the easiest one thing. And the deist said, yes, there's a God. He built all of this world. It has order to it. It may even have morality to it. But we can't really know anything about him. He just kind of set the world up, and you know, it's kind of like a clock that you build and you wind it up and you just let it go. And it's our job to just, by what we can find in this world, to figure this world out and make the best of it. Now, if you believe that the world is in fact ordered and moral, you can do a lot of pretty great things, which is why, even though a number of our founding fathers in America were deists, not all of them, but quite a few of them were, they were able to produce some pretty amazing things. Right? Wonderful things. The American founding, by the way, is a combination of pre-modern people and modernity coming together and forming a more perfect union. There were some wonderful things that they built because they thought that the world was ordered and moral. But over time, if all you're doing is staring at the world and looking for the truth in the world, you tell me, how's that going to work out? What kind of things do we find in the world that make it all of a sudden not feel so ordered or moral? Think both historically in the 1800s and in the 1900s. And think also just practically, scientifically. What sort of things kind of make the world feel not so ordered, not so moral? What do we got?
War.
War. Think of like some really big ones.
Civil War.
Civil War, World War I, World War II. There were continental wars in the 1800s in Europe. That's a big one, huge one. Doesn't look so moral if all of you're doing is looking for morality here. What else do we got?
Atomic bomb.
What's that?
Atomic bomb.
Atomic bomb.
Great Depression.
Great Depression.
Plagues.
What?
Plagues.
Plagues.
Injustice.
Injustices. How about scientifically? Atomic bomb is part of that. But you think about new scientific developments. This is hard for us to imagine, but what's that?
Electronics.
Electronics. But even theories, like you get, what?
Darwin.
Darwin.
Theory of relativity.
Theory of relativity. Even time itself, according to theory of relativity, does not exist as we thought it did. By the way, I think they're probably right on that, but I'm not a scientist.
Well, the fascinating thing is they start questioning the existence of morality based on deviations from what they perceive to be morality, indicating that in some way they actually understand that there is some sort of moral compass. They can understand that there is a right from wrong. And because of that, they're like, okay, well, is there morality since we're seeing things that break from our perception of reality?
Yeah, this is what happens in modernity. Here's another one interesting scientifically. You've got theory of general relativity, and somebody who's got a far more scientific brain can flesh this out. But as I understand it, theory of general relativity, which is Einstein and people like him, right? And then you have quantum mechanics. For those of you who are scientists, do those things match up perfectly? Not at all. There are fundamentally things that they have fundamental oppositions to them. And even that, that's exploding in the early 1900s. And people are going, well, this works for this set of problems, and this one works for this set of problems. We can't explain how they work together, but we know they do. And so scientists go, I'm really not so sure about the order part anymore. And even the moral part, David is correct, the moral part, they start to go away. They initially believe that there is such a thing as truth. True propositions correspond with reality. But what they said initially was the truth was out here. Pre-modern man said truth was up there. Modern man said truth is out here. And if we could just collect enough data and facts and experiences of the senses, we could make sense of the world as it really is. And what you've pointed out with all these things is that didn't work.
So now there is a desperate search for something called the unified field theory. Explain it all.
The bridge, you're talking about bridging quantum mechanics and general, special, actually it's properly titled special.
Bridging gravity and electrical.
Okay. All right. Yeah, trying to do that. And maybe they'll find it. Maybe they'll find it. But they are trying. Trying.
And you've got the big one.
What's that?
The Big Bang.
The Big Bang, yeah.
Their whole theory on dating rocks and minerals, because you can't date something in the past because you don't know what its original state was when it was created.
And all of this is because once you start just focusing on this only, all of these things begin to break down. That's modernity. Modernity also begins with something like this. Modernity begins with doubt. Unless you can show me, unless you can prove it to me, unless I can see it in the world, it doesn't exist. Well, of course, this begins to break down. By the time you get to people like Bertrand Russell in early 1900s, he begins to start saying that actually all moral statements are merely statements of preference. A fancy word for that is emotivism. Just emoting. It's your preference. Because you can't prove it. You can't find a universal that we can test in the world. The moral order of the world goes away. And even over time, the ordered sense of the world goes away. If we think about our illustration of the map in the city, you got streets going all over the place. You know, we've got downpouring rain. Pre-modern man says God has given us a map. Modern man says, you know what? If I just drove around long enough in this city, I could make the map. And the problem is when the rain is pouring down and there feels chaotic, how well are you going to be able to do that? You can't do that, right? Now that brings us to postmodern man. Postmodern man. By the time you get to the turn of the 20th century, modernity is beginning to collapse. As we mentioned, World War I, World War II effectively destroy it. People start to realize that you can't get enough of the information of the world to actually make sense of the world. They were still trying. Marxism, by the way, is a function of modernity. That if we could just control everything, we could actually produce the right amount of things for everybody. The problem is you realize that doesn't work not only because of human nature, but also doesn't work because we just don't know enough. In America, we tried that in different ways, from the administration of Woodrow Wilson in the economics, and then leading up to FDR. I mean, what those guys in the economic teams that were exploding in the office of the president was like, if we could just collect enough information about how the economy works, we could make sure that we could use the right means to produce a forever growing economy. And how does that work? It didn't. And it still doesn't today. Okay. People also begin to realize that in the world, the objects of the world, you never have just brute facts. They recognize that facts don't actually teach you anything. People are starting to go, actually, our interpretation of the facts is just as important. So postmodern man begins to insist that the only reality that we know is an interpreted reality. By the way, I think they're right to say that. They also are right to insist that we always interpret reality from our own situation, our own perspective. I think they're right to understand both of those. They're wrong on their solutions. Now, postmodern man, if we think about him, so we've got him. He does not deny that there is a reality around him. The issue is for postmodern man is it's not ordered. Right? It's not ordered. There's no discernible order to the world. And if you say, wow, a scientist think that, actually, not so much. That's under severe question today. Thomas Kuhn's, I think he's a British or American scientist and philosopher. Anyways, I can't remember where he's from, but he wrote books that was demonstrating that a lot of scientific theory is actually no more than someone's perspective trying to order the world. He attacks that idea that it's really hard to actually say that there is such a thing as perfect order in the world. It's not, if there is an order, it's not discernible. Postmodern man says that the world is not moral. There's no universal morals out there. And certainly for postmodern man, transcendence is not a thing. If he does exist, that's fine for you and your perspective. But there's no connection that we can perceive between this chaos that we're experiencing and if there is anything up there. Now, this is what's unique about what has happened in our world today, is that for the postmodern man, he does believe that there is the truth. But you tell me, in postmodern man, where does the truth lie? It's right here. And so what postmodern man says is, we don't have any transcendent order. We don't have any immanent order, moral order. So what I have to do is I have to make my own order on the world. I project order onto the world. Of course, the problem with that is that what about if somebody else comes along and they have a different order? And then this person over here has a different order of how they project order onto the world. And if we were just to multiply this all over, what kind of world would we live in?
Chaos.
Which is kind of like what we live in now. This is exactly our world today. And this happened. This isn't like it happened 5 years ago. This was building in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, all you needed to do was to sit at home and listen in the 90s and into the early 2000s to, at that time, the most powerful person in entertainment. And her name is? She's not so powerful anymore. I heard it. Oprah Winfrey. Who preached at literally millions of people about my truth. Anybody remember that, her talking about that? She popularized that idea. She was postmodern to the core. It's all about my truth that I project upon this chaotic world. Now, if you want to know philosophically, how did we actually get there? That's a complicated story. The short version is there was a group of people that are starting to see kind of the chaos of the world, and they start to recognize that it can't be just that we can look at the world and discover order. It's that we project meaning upon the world. They were known as phenomenologists, that there were that we would experience the phenomenons of the world and then interpret it and project meaning upon them. That's not totally wrong, but their view was, and they exist late 1800s, early 1900s, and you find them among the Germans, French, Americans, and the British. And these philosophers, they talked about that. What they still said, though, is that because we all have a common human nature, that we would all project the same meaning roughly upon the world. Well, that quickly dissipated because we figure out pretty quickly that's not the way human beings actually work. A more sophisticated philosopher named Martin Heidegger, he was a German philosopher, he comes along and he really says, no, everybody in themselves projects meaning upon the world. And he showed that by, he tried to show that by the way we use language and our imaginations. His ideas are picked up by theologians and eventually spread out into movie screens. Okay. That's a long story that I don't have time for today. But there were key philosophers along the way. A truth for this person is in me. It's not out up there. It's not out here. It's in here. This is where truth exists. And this is where we exist in our world. Now, I want to point something out that is very important to understand. Postmoderns are correct to say that we do, in fact, interpret reality from our own situation. Modern man said, hey, if we just stare long enough to what's out here, we'll figure out the way things work. That is an arrogant, self-centered way of viewing the world. So postmoderns are right to say, no, that doesn't work. Each of us interprets reality from our own perspective. That's a fine statement. I agree with that. The trouble is, for postmoderns, is since modernity had effectively killed off God, they don't have anybody to look to and say, okay, God, help me to interpret this reality rightly. They don't have it. That's our world today. So, how do we fix this? We have 2 minutes. And go. How do we fix it?
See the world from...
Second coming. Amen to that. That would fix all of that. Amen. Yes, 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 yes. All right?
See it from God's perspective.
Can we do that for our culture?
Well, the whole... Okay, I was thinking of this. What we talked sometime about intuition, okay? So you're like, sometimes your wife says, no, don't do this. And I say, what? Well, we don't have a reason. Just don't do it. But, so it ends up where that's a good advice. But then you also have discerning of spirits. Or I think, is it Elisha who, you know, is not worried? And is it Gehazi who's... worried, the servant, and you know, all the armies are there. But so one can see, one can't see. So can you see when other people can't see?
So if I hear you right, you're talking about people like us in this room, right?
They'd have to have, obviously, a knowledge of God, a relationship with God.
Yeah. Do you think that we can fix this in our culture? I'm not talking about us in this room. Can we fix this?
Only the gospel can fix it. The good news.
Only the gospel, only the good news can fix it. Go ahead.
So, how does one have the most influence on a culture that tries to determine truth from what they see? It has to start with people who are living, grounded in the truth, living out what they believe from Scripture so that other people see, hey, this works.
Listen to that answer. is very, very, very important. If we think that we can fix this by an election, now there are better and worse candidates at every level. There are moral and immoral candidates at every level. But if you think that's going to fix this chaos, no. And it isn't on all sides. Even on the what's identified today on the conservative side, if you really drill down and you start asking a huge number of them why they believe what they believe, where do they get it from? Now, we know conservatives like us, we'd say we get it from God. But if you just hang out long enough with lots of conservatives, it's all over the map. They'll talk in very broad ideas about God, but then if you look at the way many of them order their lives, it has nothing to do with God. Right? I think David is onto something that we have to begin to say, I don't think we're going to fix this except by building Christian communities like this where we faithfully live out the truth. That we live our lives as if there is order to the world that God has given, and that there's moral order to the world, and we try to uphold it. Now more than ever, because people think that they need to project their experience onto the world, experience is everything. And if they can see someone who is doing the world right, they're like, that's amazing. I know a number of years ago, and this is more than 20 years ago now, I was working at Menards and had this woman named Erica. I've shared her story before, but this is a perfect example of this. Erica's a perfect postmodern. Erica, you know, wanted to believe in an ordered world, but her whole life was chaos and she thought the world was that way. And she was probably 10 years older than me, so at the time she'd have been in her 30s or so. And one day we were working together in an aisle where we stuck together. We were actually rearranging the entire aisle of small PVC fittings at Menards. Have you ever been in there before? You know, that's a lot. And you have to do that periodically, both to clean out inventory, but also new product comes in. And when you have to move all that around, it takes a complex pattern to fix all that. And so we're doing that. We were essentially together for several days working on this project. And we had a lot of time to talk. And she had just one point. She knew as a Christian, she just finally blurted it out. And I had talked to her about things before, about the gospel. Like, what do you really believe? Like, she said that. Like, what do you really believe? I'm like, well, that's the easiest opportunity ever. And so I said, there's a God who created everything. He owns everything. He rules everything. He created a world that is ordered and right and good. Human beings messed it up. We sinned. I talked about what sin was. Gave her the gospel. Walked her through in about 5-7 minutes what I at the core believe. And I said, I live my life as if that's true. And her next words were powerful. She said, and I'll never forget this, she says, I wish I could have what you have because it's beautiful, but I just can't get there. Now in her case, she didn't get there, at least not then. I don't know where she is today, even if she's still alive, to be honest. Her life was a pretty big mess. But what it showed her, and what she actually had great respect for, is actually because she saw that my life was ordered. And it was like, that makes sense. Now, her heart wasn't there to fully embrace that, partly because she didn't like what that would mean for her life. She'd have to give up some sins. She knew that. But she saw it as a good thing. This is the primary way in which we're going to change the world. We really just need to focus on ordered lives here. I also think secondarily for us, we also need to work at actually creating a good mental map of the world as God sees it. And part of that is that we have an onslaught of people that are preaching to us a whole bunch of values that don't make sense according to God. We have to work at constantly building up our own mental map of the world that aligns with God's. It just goes to what Joe is saying. So I don't think that we can fix our culture as it is. We need the gospel. We need the second coming. But little by little, faithful Christians, over time, can do amazing things. And yes, the world is bad right now, but if the Lord tarries, and he might, I mean, what would happen if we have pockets of people like here and all over the United States and all over Europe that just live out faithfully the gospel? One of these days, eventually, this is going to run out. It will utterly collapse. It will not survive. And there might be a point in which people go, I wonder if there's something better. And we have some answers. So I don't know when that'll happen, if it'll happen before the Lord tarries, but at least something worth thinking about. All right, I need to be done because I'm over time. I hope this has been a help to think about our world as it exists today, or at least how people perceive the world. And I'd love to invite more questions, comments about it. You're welcome to talk to me about it. Again, this is really short. We could spend a lot of time on it, but just a brief overview. Thanks for coming. You are dismissed.